Right now, though, my next guest for this afternoon is on the line. His name is Eli Peled. He is a ex-spokesperson for the International as well as Arabic and Persian IDF office, and he's currently studying politics and international relations at a program by the London School of Economics. Eli, thanks for being with me on Chai FM this afternoon.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I see, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the interview, London School of Economics, Israeli with a very Israeli name. That can't be an interesting, that must be a very interesting place to be.
It is indeed an interesting time to be an Israeli abroad. I go to a very specific program by the London School of Economics. It's called Forward College. So I'm actually not studying in London itself. My program is international. So the first year I spent in Lisbon, the second year that I'm beginning in this week, actually, is going to be in Paris, and the third year is in Berlin. So the cohort and the entire environment is very international. And it is very, very interesting to be an Israeli. In fact, I'm the first Israeli to ever participate in this program. So definitely interesting time.
Interesting. I would use the word brave personally, but we'll go with interesting for now. You're a really young guy by the sounds of it, and you've already achieved remarkable feats. I mean, what is the spokesperson for the International as well as Arabic and Persian IDF office? How did that come about?
So like most Israelis, in fact, virtually all Israelis that are secular and Jewish, I got a draft letter into the IDF at the age of 17. I was meant to be drafted at 18. And it's quite normal for teenagers in Israel to go through these screening processes and try to, you know, the army and yourself as a young teenager, you try to figure out where in the military you should draft into. And I had a very keen interest in world events, and I speak English. So I was very interested in getting into the spokesperson unit. And I was very, very fortunate to pass the exams and get into this unit. So it's you know, I know it sounds pretty odd that 18-year-old people are in this unit and doing such high-stakes work, but that is actually how the IDF operates on many levels, which is quite remarkable because the work being done there is very good, high-end for the most part. I made my way. Yep.
I suppose what's surprising me, well, I don't know yet, I haven't asked the question, but we're speaking specifically about Arabic and Persian IDF office. I would have thought that there are many Arabic speakers and Persian speakers in Israel. Are you one of them?
I'm not one of them. So my entry into the Arabic and Persian media department was only later into my service after I had had enough of, you know, what I was doing. I wanted to have a bit of a change, and I had good contacts within this this branch. The spokesperson, the lead spokesperson to the Arab world, Avichai Adrei, maybe you've heard of him. He's quite famous in the Arab world. He decided that I wouldn't be a good fit for his branch, so I got to serve under him for 6 months. I don't speak Arabic. I don't speak Persian. Oh, so wow. Most of my work was more production back, kind of behind the scenes, producing articles, producing digital media content. I wrote some podcasts that came out. So that was most of the work that I was doing for the International Arab branch.
Seems to me that Israeli media strategy has just been one utter and complete failure. Let's look at it on the other hand. Can you give me an example of where you were successful, specifically in messaging in Arabic or Persian?
So this is a good point, and I often point this out when discussing, you know, I feel like Israeli media and our attempt to explain to the world, whether it's the Arab world or the international world as a whole, trying to explain exactly what is happening and why it's happening, I feel like this whole apparatus has been somewhat of a national scapegoat to an extent, because with all fairness, you know, there are good people that sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't succeed in explaining what's happening. But again, to be frank, many of the things that are happening are really strategic blunders and real issues on the ground. A lot of mistakes that are, you know, that are happening both in conducting the war and also in running the government. And, you know, as you said, I did used to serve in the military spokesperson unit, but I don't serve there anymore. And I have a lot of, you know, different ideas of how things can be done. I think some issues that really are handled correctly often is the connection to the Jewish diaspora. I think the spokesperson unit is doing a good job keeping strong contact and realizing the importance of Jews in the world, Jews in South Africa and elsewhere in the world, everywhere. I think I was very happy to see the awareness and the importance that people place on these communities worldwide, and, you know, making sure that they are at least still very much invested in the Zionist idea. But I definitely think that the issues with trying to explain, again, both of the Arab world and to the international community, what is happening in Israel, what is happening in Gaza, it's somewhat of an impossible task, because Israelis themselves often don't understand the decisions made by the government, by the military high officers. A lot of the decisions, really, if you contextualize them with domestic politics, you begin to realize that really things are not as straightforward as they seem. They're not as always, I would say, honest. A lot of these politicians, a lot of these military commanders, they're really not looking out for the best of the country. This is my personal opinion.
Well, I mean, you can go even higher than that. You could look at Benjamin Netanyahu, who fires a guy like Elon Levy because once upon a time he went to demonstrate against the judicial reform. I mean, what a loss that was for Israel. This guy could have been a spokesperson for the past 2 years, selling in Oxford English Israel's case to the world. But instead, no, personal politics got in the way. That's just my take on it. What's yours?
Absolutely, I agree. I think Elon Levy was a national asset, and he's a great man. And I think it's really a shame that he didn't get to continue doing what he was doing so well. But I will reemphasize this, because at the end of the day, this is what matters the most. It's not always possible to explain and sell to the world our narrative if it is a one-sided narrative. Because in reality, and this is something that I used to face constantly when I was in the military spokesperson unit, I would see a story that was complicated. It was nuanced. It really needed detail. It needed people to understand that there are two sides to things. And often I would get all these international media companies, and mostly American media outlets, that really wanted to tell a very, very one-sided and anti-Israel story. But on the other hand, I would also be exposed to the military aspects of things and to the spokesperson unit and the way they operate. And I would see them try to do this kind of the same thing on the other side, which was only kind of allow people to know what is comfortable for the military to know, try to cover up mistakes when they are made. And, you know, this impurity of information is just, I think it's a problem.
And I think
that
huge
also
problem.
Elon Levy,
I couldn't agree with you
Elon
more.
Elon Levy too. Yeah, sorry.
No. Carry on.
I simply think that often, you know, on the national level, what Israel is trying to do is trying to present this very one-sided narrative. And this is also in policy. You know, sometimes you look at what Israel is trying to do now with this new invasion of Gaza City. One can only imagine the horror of people on the other side, whether it's our own hostages that are still there, and whether it's you know, the millions of people that are there, some of which are Hamas operatives, but the vast majority are simply civilians trying to survive these very, very difficult times. And you just wonder, like, why? Why is this the policy, and what exactly are they trying to do? So I think these things are all interconnected. It's the narrative being that they try to sell to the world, and it's the policies as well that only try to prioritize one side of things. This is a big issue.
I hear you. Also wonder how you get a message out in a world where truth has become relative. And where headlines grasp the stories and the attention. You know, I'm just thinking today of the story that came out that I'm not sure if it was an organization or members of an organization, Genocide Studies Worldwide, have taken a vote. And according to their vote, Israel is committing genocide. But what's not being mentioned is that 20% of the members of that particular organization voted. That's a crucial piece of information that is missing. Are we living in a world where now you decide if there's been a genocide or not by popular vote? Is that how we get to make philosophical and factual decisions, based on a popular vote?
Yeah, the issue of you know, this term, I mean, this is a legal claim, the claim of genocide, and it's a very complex one. And to be totally frank, I'm very careful with this term, because the more time goes by, the more I personally wonder, where is the truth when it comes to this question? Because one thing that we know is that, you know, truth is the first casualty of war, and they don't allow international media and independent media to enter Gaza and really see what's happening. Unfortunately, the only numbers we get about the casualties and the numbers are from the Hamas health ministry, which obviously has a very, very obvious bias. On the other hand, Israel doesn't really allow anyone else to enter and cover what's happening and verify the numbers. Even the international organizations that are working from the inside are, you know, they are to be trusted sometimes, sometimes they're not. So it is definitely not a matter of popular opinion whether or not a genocide is being committed on the one hand. On the other hand, at this point, we really don't have access to the information. But what I can tell you, and this is a very, very dire thing to even face, is that whether or not there is a genocide happening right now, there are genocidal people and there is genocidal intent from very, very high-ranking ministers in government. There are people like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, very, very important politicians in Israel, that openly say that they want the displacement, they want the killing, and they want the starvation of millions of people. And if you look at polls made in Israel, a very, very troublingly large percent of the population is not actually opposed to these ideas. So, you know, this whole issue of genocide is, as you said, it's not a matter of popular opinion. It is a matter of fact. And after some time has gone by and we will have access to real protocols and the real information, we will be able to say exactly what happened. But I'm very, very troubled personally by the direction this government is taking us.
You know, we're out of time. That was a fascinating conversation. I'd like to pick up some of those points with you at a later date and continue them. We certainly couldn't accomplish everything that we wanted to in the time that was available, but thanks for talking to us this afternoon.